I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special World Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and is heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces radio network. Sports Byline has been called the Nightline of Sports for its insightful, human, sometimes humorous, and certainly always interesting interviews with the biggest names in sports. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk to Jamal Wilkes about playing at UCLA for the great John Wooden, his two NCAA championships, his 12 years in the NBA, and his four NBA championships, three of them on those great Laker teams of the 80s. Also, longtime ESPN SportsCenter anchor Linda Cohn will join us to talk about her book, Conehead, a no-holds-barred account of breaking into the boys' club. And I also talk with an old friend, Mike Epstein, who played 9 years in the majors, as we reminisce about the old days in baseball. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Jamal Wilkes. Wilkes has been a winner at every level of basketball he's played at. At UCLA, he played for the legendary coach John Wooden and won two NCAA championships and was part of the UCLA teams that won a record 88 consecutive games. He was drafted in the first round by the Warriors, where he won the first of four NBA titles, the other three with the great Laker teams of the 80s. His great, easygoing playing style earned him the nickname Silk. His accomplishments are impressive, but I asked him what he thinks about when he hears all that he's accomplished.
It's way over my head, Ron. I don't fully believe in myself. Coming out of high school, going to UCLA, playing for Mr. Wooden, Coach Wooden, and he taught this. I mean, he literally taught this about just doing the best you could and letting it all settle how it settled. And that's all I've ever tried to do. And the success I've been fortunate enough to enjoy and participate in, I still pinch myself. I really do. I mean, I remember coming out of UCLA, drafted by the Warriors. There were huge question marks in the minds of a lot of basketball people whether or not I would even last a year or two. And to have lasted much longer and to, as you just said, to have met the people that I met and played with and become friends with, I just feel so very, very, very blessed and so very, very, very fortunate.
At what age did basketball come into your life?
I actually started about 8 or 9 years old. I grew up in Ventura, California, which had great youth sports programs. And I actually loved to play baseball. Baseball was my favorite sport as a kid. And I was playing, we would go up to the high school. The high school team, well, back then, this is the early, mid-60s, so we didn't have all the cable. We didn't have all the options that the young people have today. That tells you how old I am. But the high school program was huge in the little city, and so we would go there on weekends and, you know, try and get asked to play in a game, you know, like pickup basketball. So one day the high school coach, Bob Swanson, great man, he saw me out there, and I think he'd been hearing about me, and he said, "Hey, kid, you know, that's pretty good. Can you do that with your left hand?" And it really challenged me, and it really got my attention. And he took an interest in me early on. And I remember going to high school. I had a chance to play Babe Ruth baseball, which I was very excited about, or I had a chance to play varsity basketball as a sophomore. Now, then it wasn't 4-year high school. It was 3-year high school. But I had to spend the summer doing weight training, which I dreaded, which I did, and I did, in fact, that was the start of it. Things went very well from then on, but, you know, getting back to your question, I pinch myself every day. I really do.
When I think of the game of basketball, I think of the playground game. I don't know that I haven't talked to an athlete that played basketball, especially professionally, that they don't talk about those summer pickup games, the shirts against skins. I know in talking to some players that came out of New York, I'd always ask them, okay, I'm going to give you the scenario. I said, it's 9 o'clock at night. The sun's gone down. It's still 95 degrees, 95% relative humidity. Tell me what it was like. You were a West Coast guy. Was the game as intense on the West Coast as it was on the East Coast with some of those inner city playground games?
In a different way, you know, growing up where there were strong youth programs, team play was always really emphasized. From early on, that was drilled into me. So the guys I've known and played with in the inner city, it's not always so team-oriented. A lot of times it can become very individual. The intensity is there. The pride is there. Everything else is there. I actually, because I grew up in such a small city, when I was 12 or 13, I was one of the better up-and-coming players. I started playing with older guys a lot, 18, 21, military guys, who would literally beat the living daylights out of me, because the last thing they wanted was to see some 11, 12-year-old punk show them up on the court. So it was a little different because I think in the inner city, I think the flash, the style really becomes more of an issue, whereas where I grew up with the being ingrained in this team environment, it got very competitive too, but it was more a team focus.
One of the things I know about the UCLA program is that when it got going, it was one of those type of programs where I had this picture in my mind. They'd sit back in their office and say, okay, we want this kid, we want that kid. It wasn't going out and necessarily competing for kids. When was the first time you met John Wooden, and did he recruit you directly, or was it an assistant coach, and then down the line you met the coach?
I was actually recruited for the most part by Denny Crum, who eventually left and went to Louisville and had great success down at the University of Louisville. I met Coach Wooden early on in the process when I came down to visit the school. He always tells a funny story. He actually came out to see me play twice. He said, first time he saw me play, I was horrible. He always laughs when he tells that story. And the assistant coach was ready. They were ready to pass on me. And then he said, well, no. He encouraged the guy to come back and see me one more time. And apparently I made a much better impression. But at that time, mothers would give their right arm for Coach Wooden to even consider recruiting their sons. So I remember just before I made my decision, he came up. I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, and took my mom and I out to dinner, and it was definitely the close. And the thing about him, Ron, and people have a hard time believing this, he never promises you anything except a good education and a chance to compete. But he didn't promise what I was getting, a lot of under-the-table promises from other coaches at the time. But he was the consummate closer.
Did mom make the decision? Did she say, you're going there, or was it a joint decision?
She didn't make it, but she had an awful lot of influence.
I asked that because I've had a couple of coaches tell me, you sell the mom, you got the kid.
Yeah. No, she was so impressed with Mr. Wooden and his whole demeanor and just not just the winning, but just his what he represents away from basketball. And my dad was pretty impressed with him too. But you know, Ron, you never know if you're good enough on that level. You know, you always have those questions going in your mind. And other schools, maybe you can step in right away and kind of be the guy. But you know, I was going in with some awful great players and a huge tradition. But in the end, of course, I wound up going there.
One thing I know about John over the years that I've known him, I mean this in a very loving way, he was a master manipulator. He really knew how to push the buttons on his kids in the right way, and he didn't do it with any type of malice at all. He did it to challenge the person. Am I correct in that observation?
Oh, absolutely 100% correct. You know, I was around him 4 years, and I never heard him use a curse word. But having said that, the way he could say goodness gracious sakes alive sometimes, you might wish he would curse at you. He's one of the most competitive, intense human beings I've ever been around, in addition to his humanitarian side. But he could find the right buttons to push, and it was all to help you get to the next level. No malice whatsoever at all, but he was definitely could be very manipulative.
And he was a stickler for detail. I remember one time when UCLA, and you weren't there, but they were playing in the Final Four, and they had won the semifinal game that Saturday. And, of course, they played it Saturday and then on Monday, the championship game. Mm-hmm. And I remember after the game and after the press conference, I ran into him in the hallway, and I said, Coach, what did you think of that game? And he looked down at the stat sheet, and he says, oh, my goodness. He said, you know, turnovers are like walks in baseball. They'll kill you every time. And that's, you know, that was the little thing that really would bother him. I mean, he was a stickler for every minor detail.
Every minor detail and then some. He was such a stickler. And our practices even reflected that. They were very consistent and repetition of attention to detail, and it just carried over in the games to the basketball floor. He was a master at understanding the importance of details and the importance of mastering details.
What did he become a father almost to all the kids that you did not want to disappoint him?
Well, when you played for him, Ron, honestly, at the time with the tradition, which could be a little overwhelming, because you always had questions of, you know, am I at the right place? I mean, you didn't really feel that way about him then, to be quite honest. Now, I remember a couple times, and then talking, my era, Bill Walton, Greg Lee, we still kind of stay in touch occasionally. We all have our own stories. There were some days I'd go dragging into his office, just totally overwhelmed. I came from a little town. Here I am in Westwood, which is bigger than the little city I grew up in, just a university. And I'm trying to keep up with these classes and trying to compete in basketball. And I would go in there, and I guess he could just see right through me. And he would start reciting poetry and start reading poetry. And my jaw would literally hit the floor. And I would leave that meeting or visit with him just totally refreshed. He just totally took my mind off of whatever was weighing on me and took me to his world of poetry. I mean, he literally recites this stuff off the top of his head. So it wasn't until we left there and, you know, we began to really appreciate the substance of this man that the paternal-son relationship. Today, all of us think of him in a fatherly way. Those of us who played a lot, those of us who never played, we all love the man and we think of him. He's our father. But we didn't all feel that way then as kids coming through the system, but ultimately we did, yes.
It's like most kids. They don't appreciate their parents until they've gotten older.
Very well said. Absolutely right.
Let me share with you a quote. When Coach John Wooden was asked about Jamal to describe the most ideal player he could think of, he said, "I would have the player be a good student, polite, courteous, a good team player, a good defensive player in rebounding, also a good inside player, an outside shooter. Why not just take Jamal Wilkes and let it go at that?" You were a very quiet player. Was that something that you adapted to because of the personality of the other players you had on the UCLA team?
It was the type of player I had always been, and it became further emphasized because of the players that I wound up playing with, meaning that I was never a very vocal player or outwardly emotional player, and I was always taught to keep it simple, to keep it efficient. You use the least amount of energy to get the biggest result. So although it may have looked smooth and looked easy, trust me, Ron, I worked my buns off out there.
I mentioned about the two national championship teams. Which of the two were better?
Wow. That's a very good question. Yeah. I've never really pondered that myself. Most of the pundits I've heard think that the first one was better. The second one we won it, but North Carolina State was on probation that year. And then subsequently they won it the following year, or the year we didn't win it. I get asked more about the games we lost than the games we won. I think the 72 team might have been, we were just so raw and energetic and just, we were fired up, man. You go in that locker room, man, it was just high octane.
I know one of the things that John said in from his book, They Call Me Coach, he said one of the attributes of the 71-72 team was its intelligence. Was it a smart team?
Yes, we had Bill Walton and Greg Lee and myself were all academic All-Americans. And, it was a very smart team.
And I would assume that John needed to have that type of player, one that he could teach fundamentals to, could teach complexity to as well, mm-hmm. in order to be successful. I mean, he needed that himself in order to feel like he was a successful coach.
I think that's a very astute observation. And in my conversations with him, I would concur with that. He did recruit a certain type of player that thought could receive what he had to offer to get the most out of him.
When he talked about intelligence, he also said not only basketball intelligence, the players as a whole probably had more academic brilliance than any team I've ever had. Walton, Wilkes, and Greg Lee were all fine students, and Farmer and Bibby, the other two starters, I love this line, were good students, not brilliant, but good.
That's the coach. He has a way with words. He's very diplomatic.
How did he push the buttons on the players to get the most out of them? What were his little tricks? What were the little things that he would do?
Well, I think, first of all, he was a father himself, and I think he recognized that you can't treat everyone the same because people are different, especially young people. I think he recognized that, number one. Number two, I recall early in the year was when he was most critical. And I think that's when he did his most intense teaching and getting guys on his track, because he could be very critical early in the season. And then he kind of lightened up as the year went on. But you have to remember, when we were there, we knew we were in a special place with a special man. I mean, we knew that. And so it didn't take a lot to get our attention, because he was already the Wizard of Westwood, had won championships. The expectation was, could we carry on? So he had our undivided attention. But I think the key was he understood that not all people are the same, and you can't push the same button on everybody and get the same result.
One of the things that I found interesting about him is how he dealt with the individuality of the personality of players. We all know Bill Walton walked to the beat of his own drum, and I often wondered how he dealt with that. He said in the book about you, he said, seldom did Wilkes have a bad game. If his shooting was off, his defense, rebounding, and general play contributed greatly. He had the knack of always being in the right spot at the right time, and even though his shooting style was not one of accepted technique, I never tampered with it. Without doubt, Wilkes was one of the most graceful men to play in any of my teams. Wow. So you were comfortable for him, but I'm wondering about trying to mold a team together with the individual personalities, because he, you know, I know that Bill fought him quite a bit from time to time. How did he deal with those individual personalities?
Well, he gave you enough rope, you know, to hang yourself, basically. And another thing I admired about him is that he didn't look for issues. You know, he wasn't always looking for something to make an issue of. He kind of let it get to a point where he had to deal with it, like Bill when he didn't want to, you know, cut his hair and shave. I'm sure he saw it coming. And Bill's, and by the way, Bill's still a free spirit. Bill's political views. Bill grew up in a very political family, and they believe his mom and dad believed in getting involved. So I think the fact that I'm kind of losing my thought here. What was the question again?
Well, I was just asking how he dealt with the individual personalities on that team, but I think you answered it very well. One thing I wondered about, when you got drafted in the first round by the Golden State Warriors, I often wondered whether you were going to make the transition to professional football. I wasn't concerned certainly about the ability to play at that level. I was concerned about that you had come out of a system that you were comfortable with and had been taught in a particular way, that maybe the disciplines of professional basketball wouldn't be the same, and it would be something that would be very foreign to you. Were you concerned about that, and was it a transition for you?
I was concerned. I was very concerned about coming from a system. I was very comfortable. It was very disciplined. I think part of why I really clicked with Coach, aside from basketball, is my dad was of a similar ilk, a similar philosophy, had a great way with words. He said a lot in very few words. So that whole mindset was very comfortable, was what I grew up in. But coming out of college basketball, I had major concerns about adjusting. I'd seen some guys that had gone before me from UCLA who had been exceptional in college but struggled in the NBA because the world didn't revolve around them and the system was different. What helped me, two people, actually two, three really, was the veteran leadership of the Warriors. I learned a lot from Clifford Ray, just about basketball, how to get my shot off in the NBA, because the offense isn't always as tight as it is in college. There's a lot of individualism. Rick Barry helped me a lot, just talking to me. Butch Beard helped me a lot. And not only run the on-court game of the NBA, but all the stuff off the court with the NBA. Now, we weren't megastars then like they are today, but we were pretty hot. And, you know, we're making good money and so forth and so on. So the discipline, Jerry West really helped me a lot when I got to Los Angeles to understand the discipline required to be a professional in the NBA.
Yeah, because you go from team responsibility to individual responsibility in the pros.
Yeah, you really do, Ron. You really do. I mean, there's good team play in the NBA, but it's definitely a more individual thing, and the individual matchups and what your job and your responsibilities are that night. In a college game that's real tight like UCLA was, you know, you can hide certain things.
How comfortable were you with Al Addles immediately?
The first time I heard his voice, it scared the living daylights out of me.
It's like God coming out of the heavens.
Who is that talking? but the good news is everyone had told me that, now that this guy's going to scare you to death, and don't cross him because he will knock you out, but he's good as gold. So I had that insight, and so I was willing to try and, you know, get a hold of myself. But the first time I heard his voice and the intensity, you know, here's a guy I played 15 years, really was not an offensive player, was just a hard-nosed, tough-minded defensive player, playmaker guard. And I had the ultimate respect for that, but Ronnie scared me to death. First time I heard his voice, and I said, I'm never going to upset this guy.
NBA championship that rookie year?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And that was against, if I'm not mistaken, Washington, was it not?
Washington, that's right.
And did you guys sweep them in four straight?
Yes, sir, we did. Yeah.
Something that nobody expected, by the way, did they?
Oh, they still don't believe it.
Yeah. What was the essence to the success of the team that year?
Well, again, I think we were an intelligent team. We knew we weren't going to physically overpower teams. We were a very quick team. We knew when we got good shots, open shots, that we had to make them. And we had a great leader. I think Rick Barry arguably was, he didn't get MVP. He got MVP of the playoff series, but not of the season. Bob McAdoo did. And I love Bob McAdoo. I'm a big fan of his, but Rick Barry should have gotten it that year.
Jamal Wilkes, smooth as silk, on and off the court. From basketball to broadcasting, Linda Cohn is a pioneer. She joined ESPN in 1992 as one of the first and few female sportscasters on the national stage. Cohn grew up on Long Island, a hardcore Mets and Rangers fan. Her love of sports and hard work has led her to being highly respected and a fan following called Coneheads. It was only natural that her first book was titled Conehead, a no-holds-barred account of breaking into the boys' club. So I asked Cohn to give me a definition of a Conehead.
Okay, well, people are wondering, what the heck are you doing? Why'd you call your book Conehead? Well, that was easy. One of my teammates, when I was playing hockey at Oswego State, named me Conehead. Just, it was natural at the time because I played in the late 70s, and I guess she was playing off that old Saturday Night Live skit, Conehead, but they were real cones. They were C-O-N-E, head. So my book title is Conehead, as in C-O-H-N, the spelling of my last name, plus the head part. But that really was my nickname when I played goalie on the Oswego State women's ice hockey team.
I'm interested in the dedication. That caught me right away. You say this book is dedicated to all of us who have found that the road to success is neither easy nor clear and usually leads to somewhere other than where we expected it to go. How does that fit you?
You know, it fits me because sometimes there's an old saying by a very famous philosopher by the name of Yogi Berra. I think you've heard of him. And I always think about it because it always made me feel good about the choices and the roads that I took and then I did take, depending on what the situation was. And he always said, if there's a fork in the road, take it. Meaning, there's no bad decision. There's no right or wrong because you can make the best of whatever choice you make. And that's really been something I kind of swear by as I go through my life and I went through my journey professionally and personally.
One of the things I know, Linda, is that we're all a product of our background, how we were raised, the environment that we were raised in. And I found it interesting in the book you said about your family, we lived in a kind of middle-class poverty. If you were to see a snapshot of my life growing up, you might think that I had a Brady Bunch type of childhood, a typical antiseptic white middle-class upbringing. In reality, my upbringing was a little more twisted. To start with, my parents' names were the same as the Munsters, Herman and Lillian. Tell me about that upbringing.
Yeah, you know, you're not the first person that brought that up. They got a kick out of that. You know, people that are old enough to remember that old comedy, Herman and Lily, you must have. But reason why I talk about it is because the middle-class poverty thing, I grew up on Long Island in New York, and, you know, for some reason, we were a family that belonged. We were members to an exclusive hottie-totty type of tennis club in Stony Brook, Long Island. And you know, you had to have money to be members. Yet when our air conditioner or dishwasher broke down, it would stay broken for months and months and months. So somehow we were able to be members of this exclusive tennis club, yet we couldn't afford to get our dishwasher fixed. And I always found that kind of a bit strange. And you know what? But, you know, when I wrote this book, Ron, a lot of people and people that have read it said to me, I see myself in this book. And this is one of the areas where they see themselves. And I'm talking about, you know, the childhood I had, the dysfunction. I have two loving parents, yes, named Herman and Lillian, but I called him Hank, and I explain why in the book. Kind of explains a lot, because I felt like he was, like, more than, like, my best friend than he was my dad at times, because we would watch sports together. But, you know, it was a situation that it was far from perfect, and I had a tremendously a childhood that where I had tremendous low self-esteem. And I know there are a lot of women who once upon a time were little girls who just didn't feel good about their existence. And I use sports to feel good about myself and my existence.
What I found interesting was the dichotomy between your two parents. First of all, with your mother, you say, I love my mother very much, and we always had a close, if tumultuous, relationship. Explain the tumultuous part.
Well, here's what happens. To this day, whenever there's a loud noise, unexpected, you could see me jump from a mile away. It really kind of gets on my nerves. And this dates back to when I was a child, and my mother loved her dearly, was really a role model for me, always made me believe I could do whatever I wanted to do. Yet, she tended to lose her temper at times when you least expect it. And I talk about a story, I laugh now. But I was with, back in the day, you know, the Beatles. You might have heard of them. They were a very successful group. And I listened to them. I was listening to an 8-track, and you remember those. And it was a song was called A Day in the Life, and it's a classic Beatles tune. Anyone who knows it knows that there's a point at the end of the song that gets just so moving, like it just rocks your world. And it was up very loud because I liked to play my music loud growing up. And my mother came home from a long day at work, heard that, out of nowhere, came up the stairs, grabbed that 8-track, pulled it out, and threw it against the wall and smashed it, just out of nowhere. So you always had to be on guard regarding my mother's unexpected moods.
What I found interesting also, and again, it was a dichotomy, Linda, was the fact that your mother did not want you to play the drums because she thought it was too masculine, but yet she was the one that really encouraged you to play hockey.
That's exactly true, and that is why she learned her lesson, because I did want to play the drums, because sports as well as music fill those voids I talked to you about, you know, feeling good, finding something to look forward to, whether it was a concert or whether it was a sporting event. And I thought, you know, this shy little girl, I want to play the drums. I don't know why, but my mother said it wasn't feminine enough. And so that was back in fifth grade. And then years later, at the age of 14, when I was in eighth grade, I said to her, and she was slowly noticing that she was going to lose this battle, because the first sport I ever played was tennis, and I was good at it. But at the age of 14, I really wanted to play ice hockey. I was playing street hockey with the boys, and I had an opportunity to play ice hockey, and I wanted to be a goalie. And I said, Mom, I want to join this league. They actually let girls play with boys. Can you take me 45 minutes each way, and can I do this? And she said, absolutely. And she worked full time, but she knew, she learned her lesson. And something inside her knew this was going to be a turning point of my young life.
And of course, you've always been kind of gutty, and I think that was proven by the belief that you could play hockey, but you didn't know how to skate, did you?
Yeah, and you know, Ron, that's great you brought that up because people put in, are in shock when they hear that. I loved it so much, I was going to force myself how to skate, and I did so, and I learned how to skate, not on figure skates, for goodness sake, but on goalie skates with 40 pounds of equipment attached to my little body. That's how I learned how to skate, and of course, I can even skate backwards.
And, of course, you were the goalie for the high school boys' team, and I thought when I read that chapter about the book, you were undaunted, and I really think that as young as you were, that made you able to be undaunted. Am I correct in that, Linda?
Absolutely. I made that boys' high school hockey team of mine in my senior year, and I tried out in my junior year as well, but I opened up some eyes, but I wasn't good enough then. But another year of playing, you know, the recreational league hockey on Long Island where I grew up made me better. So when I came out and tried out in my senior year, you got to believe, I'm telling you right now, I was so still and very much so very nervous because I really wanted to make this team and I was really ready to. And I bring this up because I had to believe in myself, and that was very difficult for me, even though I got better year after year. Remember, we're talking about a kid with, like, no self-esteem. That was me, a kid that had no friends in high school. That was me. All that I wanted was to make this hockey team. And I had the faith in my skills and my ability, and I put a Teflon shield around me. In this case, it was my goalie mask. And when I look back on it, I always think, I want to... One of the reasons why I picked and decided to be a goalie was because I could hide behind that mask where I couldn't be judged, and I can only be judged on something I love, my ability. So I look at that, and I look at my ability to play goal, and I see now when I got the courage and when I got the nerve, you know, to be a sportscaster in a man's world, I said, you know, this is very similar to something I did when I was young.
When did you know? What was that moment on that boys' hockey experience that you knew you'd been accepted by the boys as an equal player?
Well, when I saved the game, I was brought in to back up. You know, I was a backup goalie, so I got to start about 8 of the games. And, you know, there was a game, it was a schedule that lasted about 25 games. But there was a turning point when our first string goalie, Mike Alaco, was getting blasted. Our team was down 6-2. My coach put me in when we were down 6-2. He figured, what the heck, let's shake up this team. My team, I made a big save right away at the beginning of the game on a breakaway, and then my team came back, tied up the game, went ahead 6-5, and in the last minute, the other team had a chance to come down and score on me, and I'll always, you know, we forget so much, Ron, as we get older, but I'll always remember the guy coming down on me, I gave him room on my glove side to trick him so he would go to my glove side. He shot there, made the save, and that's when I really felt that the team realized I was the real deal.
You go on to college, and you go to State University College at Oswego. I want to hear you describe that school.
Well, you know what? I heard all the horror stories about the snow. You know, I mean, and they were horror stories. Anyone who has never been in a climate like this with such precipitation have to be prepared. I mean, they had ropes around the campus just because you hold on for dear life. And it was a good thing that I played ice hockey because it distracted me from what the elements were. But that was just one of the things that, believe it or not, attracted me to Oswego State. I mean, I am a girl that loves challenges. And also, I was told it had some of the most beautiful sunsets in the country, and when they just kind of, the sunsets over Lake Ontario, and it was stunning. And it really, as I look back, one of the best moves I ever made going to that school. I call it the Land of Oz, Oswego State.
You describe it in the book. You say, we drank at any one of the supposedly 153 bars in the town. Maybe that's why Oswego was known as the friendly college on the lake. One of the reasons Oswego was such a big drinking school was its almost unbearable winters. The saying was that it could snow in any month with an R in it.
Exactly. You know, I'm glad you brought up the alcohol. I was waiting for you to do it. Wanted to make sure that was the direction you were going in. But yeah, for goodness sake, I mean, we're all only human. And, you know, back then when I went to college, the drinking age was 18. And the difference in why that worked back then was because in Oswego, really, nobody drove. Nobody got behind the wheel. Everybody, even in the massive snowstorms that we had, walked from place to place, class to class, and yes, bar to bar.
I was very interested in what you said about yourself and how you described after you'd gone off to college, because I think college can be a time for a young man or a woman in which they find themselves. They come to grasp with who they are and kind of blossom a little bit. And you say, I came off as dumb and flighty, what was referred to back then as an airhead. I talked very loud, inexplicably drawing attention to myself. And when I spoke, I came off as unsure, often saying something off topic or that didn't make much sense. Also, I laughed almost constantly. Actually, it was more like an uncontrollable giggle, and I laughed at everything. Was that kind of a cover-up for your insecurities at that time?
You know, I'm laughing at the part I wrote about my laugh, and to this day, I still have that uncontrollable laugh, and people that have watched me over the years at ESPN always refer to that. It seems like that I'm always laughing and having a good time. But getting back to my insecurities, I really feel, Ron, it was because I started to feel more secure in myself. Little by little, it didn't happen until I got to college, and thus, I felt confident in saying things way out loud, in calling attention to myself. And while you do bring up a good point, when many people that do have insecurities like to hear themselves speak, me, it was a sign that I'm moving forward. I am progressing. I'm feeling good about myself, that I have confidence enough that I want people to look at me and I want people to hear what I have to say.
You continued playing hockey, of course, as you were the goalkeeper for the women's team at Oswego, but your foundation for your broadcasting was started there as you began your broadcasting major, communications major. But I think as most people can hear, Lyndon, they hear on the air when they watch you on SportsCenter, you do have that definite New York accent. And in the beginning, that caused you some problems, did it not? The pronunciation aspect about how you'd say not beer, but the way you pronounced it?
Yeah, beer or coffee, like there's an A-W in the word coffee. And you know what? And I got the greatest piece of advice in Oswego from a college professor, because he noticed my Long Island accent right away. Why did he notice it? Because when I talk fast, it usually comes out. Now, he told me to lose any accent, and especially a thick one like mine, I have to talk slower and open my mouth wider when I speak. And when you do, that's a good thing, because usually also when you talk slower, you think about what you're saying. But the difference with me, unlike others he had given that tip to, was the fact that I reverted back to my accent, like when I'm talking to a friend, or like when you say, when I'm sometimes on highlights, when I'm talking about my Mets or my Rangers or my Knicks or my Giants or any New York team, I just get back in that New York flow, and I'm glad I kept my roots. You know, I'm glad I still have that accent. But yeah, when you work for a national network, you know, it's still New York, and, you know, there are some people around the country, as we all know, that they don't want to hear my New York thick accent. You know, they prefer I open my mouth wider and talk slower so they don't have to hear it.
Your first job, though, when you got out, was it not, was WALK AM and FM? Am I correct in that? And you were doing news at the beginning, weren't you?
Right, that was after I was, a Burger King hostess, and I worked as a cocktail waitress, of course, when I was about ready to give up when I got the call for my first job. Yeah, there weren't a lot of women doing sports at that time, you know, in the mid-'80s, and so I jumped at the chance to be on the radio, to be doing news updates and be a news reporter for 50,000 Watt on Long Island, 20 minutes from the house where I grew up, where I moved back to after I got out of college, and I'll tell you, I talk about in the book, Ron, several men that made a big difference in my life professionally and personally. And when you're talking about professionally, there was a news director at this first job, not only who hired me, his name is Frank Brinka, but why he was special to me is he could have gave up on me right away after he hired me. The first report, I'll never forget it. It was the first week I was working there. And this just goes to show you, just because you get a job somewhere, don't rest on your laurels. Don't think you're all that. This is a message to all young people out there, because you really have to always be on your toes. So I filed this report. It was only about 45 seconds in length. And I thought I did such a wonderful job, you know, went on the air, repeated very often along the radio airways at WALK. I get a call at home later that evening. It's Frank Brinka. He's not happy. I thought, wow, it's Frank Brinka. He's going to congratulate me on a job well done. No, he wasn't happy. Apparently, I made several grammatical errors in a report, like I said, was less than a minute long. And he was so upset. But he could have fired me right there on the spot, but he didn't. There was something there that he saw, and I had to like learn all over again. So, you know, it was a good moment because I realized that, you know, I'm really going to have to work at this. Things, not all things, will be coming as easy as I think.
Linda Cohn, talented, hardworking, and leader of the Coneheads. Finally, Mike Epstein joins us on Sports Byline. Epstein is a 9-year veteran of the major leagues back when the game was played differently and the economics of baseball was cheaper and simpler. He played for 5 teams, including the Oakland A's. Epstein was a power hitter and is one of only a few players to ever hit 4 home runs in 4 consecutive at-bats. He picked up a World Series championship ring with the 72 A's, who battled teams on the field as much as they battled amongst themselves in the locker room. Epstein is a New Yorker through and through. So I asked him, what was it like growing up in New York in the Bronx? Because that was, at least in the early part of your life, was that. Well, what was that like for you? Because New Yorkers, I've always found, are a different breed.
Well, you know, they are. And if you don't live in New York, you really begin to see that they are a different kind of breed. But they are so passionate, sports-wise, but baseball-wise, unbelievable. Of course, I grew up when the Giants were there, the Dodgers were there. The Yankees were there. Gosh, I remember we would play stickball all day in the streets. When I was young, I mean, I was 5 and 6 years old. I always had a broomstick in my hand. I mean, it was great. But that's what we did. And then when I grew a little bit older, and we moved to Westchester County up by Hartsdale and White Plains, New York, gosh, I'd hit rocks all day. I mean, I just do things myself. And kids don't do that today. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that Mel Allen was there. Red Barber was there. I'm trying to think of that Giants. Russ Hodges. Russ Hodges. They had great announcers back there. And I just sit glued to the TV, said, you know, I think that's how we learned how to play the game, just watching those guys on TV.
Were you Fantastic. A Giants fan because you grew up in the Bronx? Or
no, I was a Yankee fan. I mean, I was really a Yankee fan. I mean, they had an awards dinner one day. They had a dad's club. They didn't have any Little League in those days. Had dad's club, so they brought up Billy Hunter and Joe Collins and Johnny Hop. Billy Hunter, Hank Bauer, and Joe Collins. That's who it was. And, you know, I didn't know. I was a young kid then, you know, but it was so great. They got their autographs, got, you know, guys you see on TV. It's just, wow, here they are. And they were drunk. And I didn't know it, you know. And then later on, as I played for Hank Bauer when I came up with Baltimore, and I was telling him the first time I ever met him was, you know, in Hartsdale, New York, and he said, oh, yeah, I had to go to those things. He says, we were hammered. We were always hammered going to those things. So, you know, kids, we didn't know. I mean, these were our idols, and they treated us good. But
yeah, they talk about the time when the Yankees went out and played West Point, the cadets up there, and I guess the limo comes in from center field, and Mickey Mantle falls out of the back seat of it onto the field. We'll get into some of those stories. When did – now, you go from the East Coast to the West Coast because your dad – opened up an office on the West Coast, right?
Yeah, he opened up a West Coast office for the New York firm he was working with. And, you know, growing up in Los Angeles in the late 50s was absolutely the most incredible time. I mean, Jan and Dean, they had, you know, all the rock and roll people. The kids from the different high schools knew one another, even though we'd play against each other in football and in baseball and basketball. But we'd see each other on Hollywood Boulevard or on Saturday nights. You know, everybody had convertibles. It was what a time to live. I mean, and be a teenager. And, of course, those days will never come back. But I would say that not only that, but moving to Southern California probably accelerated my growth as an athlete because the competition out there was so good. And so many players that I played against in Southern California and these all-star teams and traveling teams, I ran into in the big leagues. And we reminisced. I mean, it was a great, great place to grow up at that time.
You were a two-sport athlete, right?
I was.
Football and baseball.
Football and baseball.
You get the scholarship to Cal, but it was for football, right?
It was for football. But I'll tell you a funny story. And it's funny how things happen in life. I always considered myself, I was always a good baseball player, always a good hitter, But I was a pitcher, and I hurt my arm because nobody knew from anything in those days. And when I was 13 or 14 years old, I was throwing well over 90 miles an hour. I mean, every scout in Southern California would come out and have me throw a bullpen. I was throwing 7 bullpens a week. And what I wound up doing was I wound up destroying my rotator cuff. And I pitched a couple of games in high school and pitched 2 shutouts and never pitched again after that. So I started to take up hitting a little bit more seriously, but football was really the sport that I really loved until I got into college. Marv Levy was a coach then, and I was recruited by Bill Walsh. Great guy. He was an assistant. Mike White, another NFL coach, head coach. Great guys. I mean, just smart people and great baseball people, or great football people. And I played my freshman year, and we played 6 games and beat everybody by 50 points a game. It was a great recruiting class, but by the time we got into being sophomores, when we could play varsity ball in those days, there were only about 5 or 6 of us left from that great recruiting class. I mean, there were like 26 high school All-Americans in that recruiting class, and I played, and I got so beat up playing. And it wasn't like it is today. I mean, it was like fun playing football. It wasn't the business it is today. But I got so beat up, I couldn't take exams, you know, because my fingers were almost broken, sprained. I couldn't write. And then we were lifting weights during the spring going into my sophomore year, and we walked up in Strawberry Canyon at Cal. The freshman baseball team was working out. So Al Matthews, who, what a terrific guy, and he's done great things here in the Bay Area in athletics at Hayward State, but Al was a great coach. And anyway, he was poking fun at some of us football players. He says, boys, he says, those are the most unathletic players you'll ever see anywhere. The only sport that can play football. They can't play a skill game like baseball. So all the baseball players were laughing, you know. So Al says, just to show you, he says, let's bring one of them over. So he yells, hey, Epstein, come on over here. Show us what you can do with a bat. I said, oh, come on, coach. I said, I'm a football player. He says, yeah, come on. I want to show something to the guys. So anyway, I missed about 5 or 6 pitches in a row. And he says, see, these guys can't do what you guys can do. So he says, I'll throw you one more, see what you can do with this one. So I hit it out of the park. Then I hit the next 11 out of the ballpark. And he says, you know, Mike, the last thing I remember was he had his arm around me. He says, we got to talk. And so that was it. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have had a baseball career.
Where were you drafted? And was it by the Orioles?
No drafting. That's how old I am.
Wow.
I roomed in Oakland with the first player taken in the draft in 1967, which was Rick Mundy. Rick and I were roommates in 1971 with Oakland, but there was no drafting. In fact, I played on the first United States Olympic baseball team in 64, and I came under another great coach, Rod Dato from Southern California. God, he was tremendous. And I hit 4th on that team and led the team in a lot of offensive categories. When I came back, all of a sudden, there were a lot of teams that said, hey, maybe this guy can really play. Maybe he can hit. And so there were about 7 or 8 teams that finally got down to the final bidding, and the Dodgers wanted to sign me in the worst way because I played for Tommy Lasorda on their traveling team, the Dodger traveling team, and Tommy came up. And as it turned out, I just didn't think that the Dodgers were the organization for me, even though I was from Los Angeles, and I wound up signing with Baltimore. And from there, that started it all.
I know you won a World Series championship ring. You also hit 4 home runs in 4 consecutive at-bats, but you have said that winning that gold medal in the 1964 Olympic Games is the most special time and special thing in your life. Why do you feel that way, Mike?
Because I'm an American. I think that's the best way to describe it. There was absolutely no feeling better than to stand there and people are cheering you for what you did. I mean, these are people from other countries cheering you, and you're standing on foreign soil. There's nothing to it. I had goosebumps up and down my spine for so long, and I know everybody on the team did. I mean, if I could just will it so every single young person in this country could grow up and do something like that on foreign soil.
How did you end up in the Orioles organization?
I actually thought that they were more the kind of organization that I thought I could play for. They had Jim Gentile, who had 40-something home runs a few years before, and they had Boog Powell. And I knew I was the first baseman. Boog was the first baseman. Boog had also played the outfield when Gentile was playing for the Orioles. And I just thought I could somehow sneak in. But as it turned out, Boog really got big, put on a little bit of weight, and couldn't play in the outfield. He had shin splints all the time, so they put him at first base. And he was a great ball player, and there wasn't any room for me. And so I wound up in Washington.
And, of course, those 2 years in the minor leagues, you had great success down there. I think 100 RBIs, 29 home runs. They bring you up in 1966 for six games. What was that experience like the first time you stepped to the plate or played in a game in the majors?
Fantastic. I mean, it was the first game I played in the major leagues. I remember I pinch hit, Hank Bauer pinch hit me against Gary Peters, a really good left-hander. And I mean, I was dialed in, and he threw me a hanging curveball, and I hit a giant, giant, giant pop-up. I was on second base when it was finally caught, and I just missed that. And that was my first time in the big leagues. But you know, an interesting story, another thing that was really stands out in my mind, my career. I was 6 years old when my uncle, and every Jewish boy has an Uncle Irving, and I had an Uncle Irving. He took me to Yankee Stadium. And in those days, you could walk out in Yankee Stadium, you know, come out of the box seats and walk across the infield, and they would open up these sliding doors in center field before they had all, you know, they had a few monuments out there, but not like the elaborate setup that they've had the last few years. But, and then people would walk out, get on the L's, go home, you know, go to their, you know, however their transportation was. And my Uncle Irving says, why don't we go down there? So I, you know, and so we went down there and we walked out and stopped at first base because we came out in the Yankee side because we're down the right field line. And I stood at first base and I just stood there. And my Uncle Irving says, well, let's go. And I says, I'm going to play here someday, Uncle Irving. And I'll never forget when I stepped out on the field. It was with Washington. The first game I played for him was in Yankee Stadium. And I walked out on the field, stood right by first base, looked up at that same light tower. Of course, didn't look as high as it did when I was 6 years old. And I said, wow, I set a goal and I got here. Unbelievable. And that was exciting.
Also, I remember, and I think I remember correctly, after you were up with Baltimore, they demoted you, sent you down to Rochester. You were not happy about that and refused to report.
I did, and I'm not so sure it was the smartest thing to do at the time, but you know, you have success, and your ego grows with your success, and you say, well, hey, I can really hit. And why are they sending me down? I have nothing to prove in AAA. I was a minor league player of the year and a player of the league in AAA. And I sat out for about a month. You know, in those days, you sit out for a month, you couldn't come back and say, okay, send me to the minor leagues on some kind of a rehab assignment and get some, you know, hitting practice off some minor league pitching. They threw you right back into the fire. And I had sat out for almost 4 weeks, and I tried to come back. And it was tough to do. And because of that, I didn't get off to that really good start that I would have liked to. But it would have been nice if I could have gone to the minor leagues for a week or week and a half and really honed up and then come back to big leagues. So once you start and you get – you're behind the eight ball, it's tough in that league to, you know, to really.
You know, Mike, one of the things I when you tell me that story, the one thing I kept thinking about was back at that time, the players had no leverage at all. And so I'm thinking to myself, weren't you afraid of being labeled a malcontent?
Oh, I've never been that kind of person.
No, you weren't. But, I mean, you were standing for a principle.
I was. And you know, actually, talk about, you know, Dave McNally, I think, was the first one that battled that reserve clause. In a way, I mean, I told Harry Dalton.
Kurt Flood also.
Well, Kurt, too, but this is way before. And Kurt and I talked about it because he was traded to Washington. And a funny story with Kurt, what a great guy he was. I mean, we really got along well. And after about a week or 2 weeks, he comes up to me and he says, goodbye. And I said, okay. You know, that's after the ball game. I said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. He didn't say anything, but he just said goodbye. And then remember, he jumped the plane and went to Sweden or something. And great guy and very highly principled. And it's a tough thing to do, to battle unions, to battle forces that you have no control over. And gosh, I remember the leverage I had with a contract here with Charlie Finley in Oakland. I mean, I was making $40,000 when I was traded from Washington to Oakland. And everybody else was making $30,000. The whole starting nine, or starting eight, or starting seven, they were making $30,000. So Dick Williams said in the paper after the 1971 season, we wouldn't have won the Western Division if it wasn't for Mike Epstein, because look what he did. He hit 20 home runs in half a season, did this, did that. And so I saved that article. And when I get my contract from Charlie, it's the same for the same $40,000 I was making in Washington. So I called him up and I said, what's going on here? Don't I get a raise? He says, you don't get a raise. And I said, why not? He says, because my other guys are just coming to $40,000 now. And I believe in bringing everybody up at the same, same incremental salary. I said, that isn't fair. I mean, I had a great year. And he said, you signed the contract. And I said, hey, wait a minute, And anyway, I sent the contract back to him, and I didn't sign it. So he rips up the contract and sends it, he gets the contract, sends it back to me, and he calls me. And he says, you signed the contract? So I'm not going to sign it. He says, do your in-laws like watching you play? Because they live in Stockton, which was, an hour away. I said, yeah. He said, well, you better sign it or else guess what? You're going to be on a plane back to Washington before you know it. And that was the leverage we had in those days. It's nothing like today.
How then did you end up in Washington with the Senators?
It dragged out for 3 weeks. I went back to my wife's hometown of Stockton, and I kept getting calls from Baltimore. I kept saying, you got to sign. Nobody does this. You got to sign. And finally, I said, look, if I don't get traded, then I'm going to sue baseball for depriving me of an opportunity to make a major league living. I mean, I have the statistics to back it up. And about 3 days later, I got a phone call and says, you've been traded to Washington for Pete Rickert, and we've got Frank Pertain along with you. And that's how quick it went after I said, we're going to do something legally, and I just got traded.
How'd you feel about that?
To be honest with you, I had nothing against Washington, but when you go from an organization at that time that Baltimore was, and you go to an organization like Washington, when I first – When I got there, the door was had. There was nobody in the office. There was no secretary. No. There was a door that was cracked open, and I could hear a guy talking. So I stick my head, and it said on the door, it said George Selkirk, general manager. So I opened the door and said, "I'm here, Mr. Selkirk." And he says, "Who the hell are you?" I mean,
he didn't even know.
Traded for me.
Yeah. Well, that is where our paths crossed, is when Mike was with the Washington Senators. And, of course, I was a young sportscaster back in Washington at that time. And, of course, while he was there, he played for the legendary Ted Williams, who, of course, a Hall of Famer and a very interesting man. My conversations with him were more along the lines of let's talk fishing, Mike talk baseball. What do you remember most about the first time you met Ted Williams?
Well, I mean, his reputation preceded him. What he told me was he actually sent a letter out, and he says, I've talked to people, and I weighed 230 pounds. He said, that's too heavy. He says, in the letter, he says, 230 is too heavy. Yeah, I want you to report at 210 pounds. And that was it. And so he said it, he must know what he's talking about, because he was the best hitter in baseball. And so I lost all that weight. I mean, I really worked out hard, lost all that weight, reported to spring training at 210 pounds, and I was getting weighed in the trainer's room. And he walks in, and he goes, Mike? And I said, yes, sir. He says, you look like shit. I said, I beg your pardon? He said, you look terrible. Are you sick? And I said, no, why? He says, you look terrible. I said, you told me to report at 210 pounds. He goes, well, we'll take care of that. We're going for some milkshakes. And that's what we did all spring. I mean, he loved milkshakes. And we went out and got, after batting practice, you know, we're the last ones to leave. We go out and get milkshakes. But he was, he really commanded. I've never, ever in my life been with anybody who, when he walked into a room, mouths would just, the bottom jaw would just fall on the chest like, wow, it's Ted Williams.
Mike Epstein, a throwback to a different time in baseball. I hope you've enjoyed World Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcasts on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 122, and the Internet. If you'd like a listing of Sports Byline's radio affiliates, be sure to check out our award-winning website at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.